All right, I'm back after that short chapter. To start, Hitler's War by David Irving, Part 3, Hitler's War Begins. And the chapter is... White. The special train America was parked in a dusty Pomeranian railroad station surrounded by parched and scented pine trees and wooden barrack huts baked dry by the central European sun. It was a cumbersome assemblage of 12 or 15 coaches hauled by two locomotives, immediately followed by armored wagons bristling with 20-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. Hitler's personal coach came first. In the drawing room, there was an oblong table with 8 chairs grouped around it. The 4 remaining compartments in Hitler's coach were occupied by his adjutants and manservants. The nerve center was the command coach, attached to his own quarters. One half was taken up by a long conference room dominated by a map table, and the other by Hitler's communications center, equipped with teleprinter and radio telephone. He was to spend most of his waking hours in this hot, confined space for the next 2 weeks. Here Keitel introduced to the Führer for the first time his chief of operations, Major General Alfred Jodl. A year younger than Hitler, Jodl was to be his principal strategic advisor until the last days of the war. In the train, as at the Chancellery, the brown Nazi Party uniform dominated the scene. Hitler hardly intervened in the conduct of the Polish campaign. He would appear in the command coach at 9 a.m. to hear Jodl's personal report on the morning situation. His first inquiry of Colonel von Vormann was always about the dangerous Western Front situation, for of 30 German divisions left to hold the 300-mile line, only 12 were up to scratch, and against them France might at any time unleash her army of 110 divisions. On September 4th, an odd Colonel von Vormann wrote, "Meanwhile, a propaganda war has broken out in the West. Well, will the Führer prove right after all? They say that the French have hung out a banner at Saarbrücken reading, 'We won't fire the first shot.' Poland was overrun in 3 weeks. Neither the bravery of her soldiers nor the promises of her allies prevented this overwhelming defeat. The gasoline engine, the tank, and the dive bomber should not have taken the Poles by surprise, but they did. Hitler's armored and mechanized units encircled the enemy armies while they were still massed to the west of the Vistula, where they had deployed in preparation for the drive to Berlin, the thrust which would bring about an anti-Nazi revolution in Germany. What had been planned on the maps of the German general staff throughout the summer now took precise shape in the marshlands and fields of Poland in September 1939. Hitler listened unobtrusively to all that went on about him in the command coach. His being there did not distract his staff, as one member wrote, except that they were forbidden to smoke in his presence, a prohibition that fell heavily on his cigar-smoking naval adjutant. Hitler's only strategic influence had been on the Grand Pincer Plan, with its powerful southward thrust, with mechanized forces from East Prussia behind the Vistula. He had also attempted to veto the appointments of Generals Johannes Blaskowitz to command the 8th Army and Gunther von Kluge, the 4th Army. The former because he recalled that, in his maneuvers 3 years before, the general had not committed his tanks as he himself would have considered best. Hitler did later find fault with the conduct of the 8th Army's operations. This produced the only real crisis of the campaign, but the crisis occurred precisely where Hitler had expected, and he had ordered countermeasures in anticipation. At 8 o'clock on the morning of September 4th, General von Bock, the commander of Army Group North, joined Rommel in reporting to Hitler, and the three men set out on an extended tour of the battle areas. Hitler rode in a heavy six-wheeled Mercedes, and the rest of his staff and escort followed in 6 identical vehicles. 70 or more cars packed with party and ministerial personages jostled for position behind the Führer's convoy. At each brief halt, Hitler's generals and party leaders elbowed their way into the foreground of the photographs being taken, and then galloped back to their cars to urge their chauffeurs into even closer proximity to the Führer's Mercedes. Once, when Bormann angrily rebuked Rommel for these scenes of disorder, the general coolly snapped back, "I'm not a kindergarten teacher. You sort them out if you want." The Wehrmacht was already steamrolling northward toward Thorn. These were fields long steeped in German blood. On the sixth, Hitler toured the battlefield of Tuscheler Heide, where a powerful Polish corps had been encircled. Apparently convinced that the German tanks were only tin plate dummies, the Polish cavalry had attacked with lances couched. A radio message told Hitler that Krakow was now in German hands. At 10 p.m. that evening, Colonel von Vormann briefed him on the Western Front. "The phony war continues," he wrote later that day. So far, not a shot has been fired on the Western Front. On both sides, there are just huge loudspeakers barking at each other, with each side trying to make it clear to the other how impossible their behavior is and how stupid their governments are. Vormann talked of the dissolution of the Polish army. "All that remains now is a rabbit hunt. Militarily, the war is over." Beaming with pleasure, Hitler took the colonel's hand in both of his and pumped it up and down. The situation in the West had a comic opera quality. There were secret exchanges of food and drink between the French and German lines. Hitler went out of his way to avoid provoking British public opinion. When Goering begged for permission to bomb the British fleet, Hitler rejected the request. He was furious when Britain announced on September 4th that one of her transatlantic liners, the Athenia, had been torpedoed by a German submarine. Admiral Raeder assured him that none of their handful of U-boats could have been near the alleged incident. Hitler suspected that Churchill had himself ordered the liner sunk to arouse American public opinion. Shortly afterward, however, Raeder advised him confidently that a U-boat commander had now admitted the sinking. The liner, he contended, had been blacked out and zigzagging. Raeder and Hitler agreed to keep the truth to themselves. Hitler's territorial plans for Poland were still indeterminate. In a secret speech to his generals on August 22nd, he had set as his goal the annihilation of the Polish forces, rather than any particular line on the map. But on September 7th, he also mentioned to his army commander-in-chief, General von Brauchitsch, the possibility of founding an independent Ukraine. Hitler's notion was to mark the ultimate frontier between Asia and the West by gathering together the racial German remnants scattered about the Balkans, Russia, and the Baltic states to populate an eastern frontier strip along either the River Bug or the Vistula. Warsaw would become a center of German culture, or alternatively, it would be razed and replaced by green fields on either side of the Vistula. Between the Reich and the Asian frontier, some form of Polish national state would exist, to house the ethnic Poles, a lesser species of some 10 million in all. To stifle the growth of new chauvinistic centers, the Polish intelligentsia would be extracted and accommodated elsewhere. With this independent rump, Poland, Hitler planned to negotiate a peace settlement that had some semblance of legality, and thereby spike the guns of Britain and France. If, however, this rump Poland fell apart, the Vilna area could be offered to Lithuania, and the Galician and Polish Ukraine could be granted independence. In which case, as Canaris noted, Keitel's instructions were that his Abwehr-controlled Ukrainians are to provoke an uprising in the Galician Ukraine with destruction of the Polish and Jewish element as its aim. Hitler's army had fallen upon the hated Poles with well-documented relish. Colonel Edward Wagner, as quartermaster general, initially responsible for occupation policy, wrote privately on September 4th, "Brutal guerrilla war has broken out everywhere, and we are ruthlessly stamping it out. We won't be reasoned with. We have already sent out our emergency courts, and they are in continual session. The harder we strike, the quicker there will be peace again." And a week later, "We are now issuing fierce orders, which I have drafted today myself. Nothing like the death sentence. There's no other way in occupied territories." Hitler and his generals were confronted by what they saw as evidence that Asia did indeed begin just beyond the old Reich frontier. In the western Polish town of Bydgoszcz, and in parentheses, Bromberg. I'm going to say Bromberg instead. The local Polish commander had ordered the massacre of several thousand German residents, on the charge that some of them had taken part in the hostilities. Goering's paratroopers were being shot on the spot when captured by the Poles. The population was instructed, for example, to pour gasoline over disabled German tanks and set them on fire. Against Germany, the Polish people fight side by side with Polish soldiers, building barricades and combating the German operations and positions by every means they can. Hitler's special train, America, had left for Upper Silesia on the 9th. It finally halted in a railway siding at Ilmenau. The air outside was thick with the hot dust particles of mid-September. His secretary, Christa Schroeder, wrote plaintively, "All day long, the sun beats down on the compartments and we just wilt in the tropical heat. The chief drives off in the morning, leaving us condemned to wait for his return. Recently, we were parked one night near a field hospital through which a big shipment of casualties was just passing. Those who tour Poland with the chief see a lot, but it's not easy for them because the enemy are such cowards, shooting in the back and ambushing. And it's because it is difficult to protect the chief, who is taken to driving around as though he were in Germany, standing up in his open car even in the most hazardous areas. On the very first day, he drove through a corpse still swarming with still swarming with Pollux. Just half an hour earlier, they had wiped out an unarmed German medical unit. One of the medics escaped and gave him an eyewitness account. Once again, the Führer was standing in full view of everybody on a hummock, with soldiers streaming toward him from all sides. Obviously, it gives the soldiers' morale a colossal boost to see the F in the thick of danger with them, but I still think it's too risky. We can only trust in God to protect him. The Führer is in the best of moods. I often get into conversation with him, wrote General Rommel. He says that in 8 or 10 days it'll all be over in the east, and then our entire battle-hardened Wehrmacht will move west. But I think the French are giving up the struggle. Their soldiers are bathing in the Rhine, unmolested by us. This time, he concluded, we are definitely going to win through. That day, September 12th, Hitler summoned Goering, Brauchitsch, and Keitel and flatly forbade them to provoke the French in any way. Hitler had walked into the command coach just as Canaris was outlining to Keitel the unfavorable effect a German bombardment of Warsaw would have on foreign opinion. When asked for news from the Western Front, Canaris craftily replied that the French were systematically marshaling troops and artillery opposite Saarbrücken for a major offensive. And there's an asterisk right there. Canaris had deliberately exaggerated reports of a planned minor French attack in the hope of disrupting Hitler's Polish campaign strategy, according to Colonel Lehosen, who accompanied him. Hitler remained politely incredulous. I can hardly believe that the French will attack at Saarbrücken, the very point at which our fortifications are strongest. Jodl added that the artillery preparation for a major offensive would take at least 3 weeks, so the French offensive could not begin before October. Yes, responded Hitler, and in October it is quite chilly, and our men will be sitting in their protective bunkers while the French have to wait out in the open air to attack. And even if the French should manage to penetrate one of the weaker points of the West Wall, we will in the meantime have brought our divisions across from the east and given them a thrashing they'll never forget. Hitler's tours of these Polish battlefields were his first real contact with the east. They reinforced his unhealthy fantasies about the subhumans and the Jews. Was this still Europe, indiscriminately scattered about the untended acres, were wretched wooden hut-like dwellings with thatched roofs? At the roadsides, knots of submissive Polish civilians stood in the swirling dust of Hitler's motorcade. Among them he glimpsed Jews in high-crowned hats and caftans, their hair in ritual ringlets. They looked for all the world like figures out of medieval anti-Semitic drawings. Time had stood still here for centuries. The Jews were the enemy. Dr. Chaim Weizmann, the president of the Jewish Agency, had written to Neville Chamberlain promising explicitly that all Jews everywhere would fight on the side of the democracies against Nazi Germany. The Times published Weizmann's letter on September 6th, and Hitler no doubt considered it a Jewish declaration of war. He often referred to it in later years, by which time his grim prophecy was being cruelly fulfilled. "For the first time, we are now implementing genuine ancient Jewish law," he boasted in January 30th, 1942, "an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. For the pogroms that now began, Himmler and Heydrich provided the initiative and drive themselves. Hitler's only order to the Reichsfuhrer SS, Himmler, in this context, was one for the general consolidation of the German racial position. The army generals became restless about deeds being enacted by the SS in Poland, but Himmler reassured them in a secret speech at Koblenz in March 1940, of which his handwritten notes survive. He explained that now for the first time under Adolf Hitler, the solution of the thousand-year-old problem of Poland was possible. Only the infusion into Poland of Germanic blood had made some Poles great and dangerous. Now that Germany was strong, she must see to the final annexation of the area, its purification and Germanization. But a Bolshevik method, which Himmler defined in a memorandum 2 months later as downright extermination of the minority races, was impossible. He conceded that the leading brains of the resistance were being executed, but this was not stressed. Himmler, a wild excess by subordinate commanders, still less by me. Here Himmler's jottings show a German phrase, "Weiss er genau was vorgeht," which might be translated as either "I know precisely what is happening" or "He knows precisely what is happening." And there's an asterisk. General Ulichs, who was present, recalled this after the war as, "I am doing nothing of which the Führer does not know." Professor Helmut Krasnick, "Hitler and the Murders in Poland, 1963. However, nobody else recalled this. And General von Lieb, whose diary has been available to me, would certainly have mentioned such a candid statement in it, given his pronounced Christian convictions. Ulichs had been humiliated by Hitler late in 1938. Let it be noted, however, that Colonel Eduard Wagner wrote his wife on the following day, "In the evening, Himmler spoke to the commander-in-chiefs at Koblenz. More about that verbally." And back up. 2 weeks later, Himmler spoke in a Ruhr city. Here his notes read, "The Führer's mission to the Reichsführer SS, the quality of the German species, blood our most supreme value, new territories not a political but an ethnological problem." As in Austria and Czechoslovakia, the advancing tide of German army units had been followed by Heydrich's police net. Each army had its task force, Einsatzgruppe, and each corps had an Einsatzkommando of 100 officials and Waffen-SS uniform with FD, Sicherheitsdienst, Security Service, emblems on their sleeves. Their primary role was intelligence, seizing enemy documents and what the army orders more formally described as combating any anti-Reich or anti-German elements in rear areas. According to Heydrich, writing 10 months later, the special order directing the task forces to conduct security operations of a political and ideological nature in these new territories was issued by Hitler himself. Parallel to the SS task forces attached to the armies, there was an independent special duties task force under the command of the arrogant and brutal SS General Udo von Wolters. When he was eventually kicked out of Poland on German army orders, he loudly protested that he had received direct instructions from the Führer via Himmler to spread fear and terror to dissuade the Poles from committing acts of violence. Himmler's orders to Wojtek survive, dated September 3rd. He was charged with the radical suppression of the incipient Polish insurrection in the newly occupied parts of Upper Silesia. Hitler is not mentioned. There is no surviving record of when or if Heydrich conferred with Hitler during the Polish campaign, but many of Hitler's generals learned from him that he planned to eliminate the Polish intelligentsia one way or another. They joined a conspiracy of silence. Hitler's blood was already boiling at the ponderous court-martial procedures being implemented against Polish guerrillas. He wanted their swift and summary execution. On September 7th, he had met with Brauchitsch in his private coach and for 2 hours discussed the political future of Poland. He instructed the army to abstain from interfering in the SS operations, and the next day he issued a set of guidelines in which the emphasis was on the appointment of party functionaries as civil commissars to do the dirty work in Poland. Little is known in detail of what Hitler told Brauchitsch. After talking to Halder on the 9th, Eduard Wagner noted in his diary that it is the Führer's and Goering's intention to destroy and exterminate the Polish nation. More than that cannot even be hinted at in writing. The same day, Colonel von Vormann wrote, "The war in Poland is over. The Führer keeps discussing plans for the future of Poland. Interesting, but scarcely suited for committing to writing." Only General Walter Heitz, the new military governor of West Prussia, lifted a corner of his veil of secrecy in writing up a conference with Brauchitsch on December 10th. "Other business. I am to rule the area with the mailed fist. Combat troops are over-inclined toward a false sense of chivalry." That the nature of the SS task force operations had been explained to Brauchitsch was established when Admiral Canaris reminded Keitel of the damage of the planned widespread executions of Polish clergy and nobility would inflict on the Wehrmacht's reputation. Keitel retorted that this had been long decided by the Führer, who had made it plain to Brauchitsch that if the Wehrmacht wants nothing to do with it, they will merely have to put up with the SS and Gestapo appearing side by side with them. Hence the creation of parallel civil authorities in Poland. On them would fall the job of demographic extermination, as Canaris recorded Keitel's phrase. When Heydrich informed Colonel Wagner that the planned mopping up of Poland would embrace the Jewry, intelligentsia, clergy, and nobility, the army officer asked only that the murderous orders flow directly from Heydrich to his task forces in the field. But Heydrich had not, in fact, secured Hitler's approval for liquidating the Jews. On September 14th, he reported to his staff on his tour of the task forces. The discreet conference record states, "The chief Heydrich enlarged on the Jewish problem in Poland and set out his views on this. The Reichsfuhrer, that is Himmler, will put certain suggestions to the Führer, on which only the Führer can decide, as they will also have considerable repercussions abroad. Hitler, however, favored only a deportation of the Jews, as became clear to both Brauchitsch and Himmler when they conferred separately with Hitler at Zapat on September 20th. To Brauchitsch, he talked only of a ghetto plan for the Jews. Hitler's somewhat more moderate instructions to Himmler were presumably those echoed by Heydrich to his task force commanders in Berlin the next day. The formerly German provinces of Poland would be re-annexed to the Reich, an adjacent Gau, or a district made up of a Polish-speaking population, would have Krakow as its capital and probably be governed by the Austrian Dr. Arthur Seyss Inquart. This Gau, the later general government, would be a kind of no-man's land outside the planned East Wall. It would accommodate the Polish Jews. Hitler also authorized Heydrich to unload as many Jews as possible into the Russian zone. To facilitate this expulsion, the Jews were to be concentrated in the big Polish cities. They would be joined by the Jews and the remaining 30,000 gypsies from Germany. Hitler asked Himmler to act as overlord of this resettlement operation, what would in later years be called ethnic cleansing. For his part, General von Brauchitsch circularized his field commanders thus. "The police task forces have been commanded and directed by the Führer to perform certain ethnographical Volkspolitische tasks in the occupied territory. The only stipulation Brockich made when he met Heydrich on September 22nd was that the expulsion operations must not interfere with the army's movements or Germany's economic needs. Heydrich readily agreed. Hitler's positive enjoyment of the battle scenes was undeniable. He visited the front whenever he could, at a divisional headquarters set up in a school within range of the Polish artillery. He made the acquaintance of General von Briesen. Briesen had just lost an arm leading his division into action, which warded off a desperate Polish counterattack by four divisions and cavalry on the flank of the Eighth Army. He had lost 80 officers and 1,500 men in the fight, and now he was reporting to his Führer not far from the spot where his father, a Prussian infantry general, had been killed in the Great War. On the 15th, we find Hitler at Yaroslav, watching his soldiers bridging the River San. On the next day, the greatest strategic triumph of the campaign was complete. The Polish army, optimistically assembled at Posen for the attack on Berlin, had been encircled, and Kutno had been captured by the 4th and 8th armies. Now it was only a matter of days before Warsaw itself fell. Hitler had begun to debate the fate of that city with Jodl on the 15th. He was particularly eager to have the capital in his hands by the time the U.S. Congress reconvened. He hoped that the mere threat of concerted ground and air attack would suffice. He plagued his officers for estimates on how long it would take to starve the city into submission. Early on the 16th, a German officer carried to the Polish lines an ultimatum giving the commandant 6 hours in which to surrender. The commandant refused even to receive the ultimatum. He had spent every waking hour preparing the capital for the German assault. All fortifications and defenses had been strengthened. Every suburban building had been reinforced by sandbags, concrete, and barbed wire, its basement linked by a honeycomb of tunnels to a network of resistant strongpoints. Deep anti-tank trenches cut across Warsaw's main thoroughfares, and there were barricades formed of heaped-up streetcars, cobblestones, and rubble. As Blaskowitz was later to report, "What shocked even the most hardened soldier was how at the instigation of their military leaders' misguided population, completely ignorant of the effect of modern weapons, could contribute to the destruction of their own capital." At 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the 16th, Luftwaffe aircraft released over Warsaw several tons of leaflets. Thought I was going to say bombs, didn't you? Giving the civilian population 12 hours to leave by two specified roads. At 6 p.m. the next day, the Deutschlandsender broadcast an invitation to the Polish forces to send officers to the German lines for negotiations to begin at 10 p.m. Any officers who turned up for negotiations were to be instructed to hand their commandant an ultimatum calling for the unconditional surrender of the capital by 8 a.m. the next day. Arrangements for the evacuation of the diplomatic corps would be made on request. By 11:45 a.m. on the 18th, no Polish officer had appeared at the German lines. Hitler's attempts to obtain the city's bloodless capitulation were sufficient to give him a clear conscience about destroying Warsaw when the time came. The Polish government had already escaped to neutral Romania to protect the interests of the Ukrainian and White Russian minorities. Two Soviet army groups invaded Eastern Poland in the small hours of September 17th. The news reached Hitler's train soon after. At about 4 a.m., he entered the command coach, where he found Schmunt waiting with Keitel and Jodl. All of them were grouped around the maps of Poland, guessing at the Soviet army's movements, until the arrival of Ribbentrop, who on Hitler's instructions now revealed to the astonished generals the details of secret arrangements made with Moscow for Poland. "We decided with Stalin on a demarcation line between the two spheres of interest running along the four rivers, Pisa, Narev, Vistula, and San," the foreign minister explained as he somewhat crudely drew the line on the map. By September 19th, when Hitler and his staff drove into Danzig, the Polish campaign was all but over. How he now privately mocked the foreign ministry Cassandra's, who had predicted military disaster. There's an asterisk right there. C.F. Hewell's unpublished diary, October 10, 1941. Triumphant conversation with the Führer about the foreign ministry, who in 1939 believed in victory. The state secretary at the foreign ministry, Wiesacker. And that's it. That's all the asterisk there is. Only the garrisons of Warsaw, Modlin, and Hila were still holding out. As the victorious Führer drove through the streets of Danzig, flowers rained down from the windows. When the convoy of cars stopped outside the ancient Artushof, Schmidt was heard to comment, "It was like this everywhere, in the Rhineland, in Vienna, in the Sudeten territories, and in Memel. Do you still doubt the mission of the Führer?" Here in a long-columned 14th-century hall built in the heyday of the Germanic knightly orders, Hitler delivered a lengthy speech. He compared the humanity with which he was fighting this war with the treatment the Poles had meted out to German minorities after Pilsudski's death. Tens of thousands were deported, maltreated, killed in the most bestial fashion. These sadistic beasts let their perverse instincts run riot, and this pious democratic world looks on without batting one eyelash. In his peroration, he spoke of Almighty God, who has now given our arms his blessing. Afterward, his staff cleared a path for him through the heaving Danzig population packed into the long market outside. A bath was provided for the sweat-soaked Führer in one of the patrician houses. He took up quarters for the next week in the roomy seafront casino hotel at Zapat, near Danzig. His mood was irrepressible. At midnight, 2 days after his arrival, followed one of his manservants with a silver tray of champagne glasses, he burst into Jodl's room, where a number of generals were celebrating Keitel's birthday, but his ultimate intentions remained the same. Here, at Zapat, Hitler began weighing a course of action as hideous as any that Heydrich was tackling in Poland. About 250,000 hospital beds were required for Germany's disproportionately large, insane population. Of some 700,000 or 800,000 victims of insanity all told, about 10% were permanently institutionalized. They occupied bed space and the attention of skilled medical personnel, which Hitler now urgently needed for the treatment of the casualties of his coming campaigns. According to the later testimony of Dr. Karl Brandt, his personal surgeon, Hitler wanted between 40% and 60% of the permanently hospitalized insane to be quietly put away. To his suite at the Casino Hotel, the Führer now summoned his constitutional and medical advisers, and in particular Hans Lammers, chief of the Reich Chancellery, and Dr. Leonardo Conti, chief medical officer of the Reich, together with the ubiquitous Martin Bormann and Reichsleiter Philipp Buhler, chief of the Führer's Chancellery. Conti's widow still recalls her husband reaching for the encyclopedia to look up euthanasia after the Führer's call. Hitler instructed Dr. Conti that to meet the requirements of wartime, a program for the painless killing of the incurably insane should be initiated. Dr. Conti questioned whether there was any scientific basis for assuming it would produce eugenic advantages. There was some discussion of the actual mechanics of the program Dr. Conti proposed Dr. Conti proposed the use of narcotics, but in separate discussions with Dr. Brandt, Hitler learned that barbiturates would be too slow to be humane, and that most physicians considered carbon monoxide gas the fastest and most peaceful lethal dose. Hitler asked Brandt shortly to investigate which was the fastest way, consequent with the least amount of pain. He had been an enthusiastic advocate of the racial rejuvenation of the German people ever since the 20s. On the pretext that 20% of the German population had hereditary biological defects, the National Socialists had instituted a program of racial hygiene immediately after they came to power. Minister of the Interior, Wilhelm Frick, was a fervent advocate. In July 1933, the cabinet had passed the first related law. It was henceforth obligatory for doctors to report on patients with hereditary diseases so that they could be sterilized. An elderly Darwinian, Alfred Plotz, whom the Reich had made a professor after 1933, was to point out in 1935 that the contraselective effects of war must be offset by an increase in the extermination quotas. Frick had drafted the necessary laws governing the operations of the local health offices in 1934, parallel to the racial politics agencies of the party, which functioned in each party district. Over the next 10 years, tens of thousands of senior medical officials were to pass through special courses in racial hygiene. The economic burden represented by these specimens was explained, and particularly repulsive samples were housed at the institutions as walking laboratory exhibits. In 1935, Hitler openly told Dr. Conti's predecessor that should war come, he would tackle the euthanasia problem, since a wartime psychology would reduce the risk of opposition from the church. But it was not until the end of 1938 that Hitler was directly involved in any euthanasia decisions, and then it was in mercy killing. Böhler's chancellery had repeatedly submitted to him appeals from patients in intolerable pain or from their doctors, asking Hitler to exercise the head of state's prerogative of mercy and permit the doctor to terminate the patient's life without fear of criminal proceedings. When Hitler received such an appeal from the parents of a malformed, blind, and imbecile boy born in Leipzig, he sent Dr. Brandt early in 1939 to examine the child, and he authorized the doctors to put him to sleep. A ministerial decree was eventually passed in August 1939 requiring all midwives to report the details of such deformed newborn babies. A panel of three assessors judged each case, and if all three agreed, the infant was procured from the parents either by deception or by compulsion, and quietly put away. After the Zapat meeting, some time passed without any results. In fact, Dr. Conti had become involved in lengthy discussions in which the legal and ethical bases of Hitler's proposals were explored. The consequence of this delay was that Hitler bypassed both Lammers and Conti and peremptorily dictated onto a sheet of his private stationery an order that considerably enlarged the scope of the euthanasia project. Reichsleiter Böhler and Dr. Brandt, M.D., are herewith given full responsibility to enlarge the powers of certain specified doctors so that they can grant those who are by all human standards incurably ill a merciful death, after the most critical assessment possible of their medical condition. Signed, Adolf Hitler. This Führer order was symbolically backdated to September 1st, the start of what he had envisaged as his First Silesian War. Now it was no longer a local campaign, but a bloody crusade in the course of which the German people were to become ennobled by conflict and purged of the impure elements in their blood and seed. Census forms, ostensibly for statistical survey purposes, were circulated to doctors and hospitals from October 9th. Panels of three assessors then decided the life or death of each patient on the basis of these forms alone. Hitler told Böhler he wanted a process untrammeled by red tape. What had begun as the mercy killing of the few was now followed by the programmed elimination of the burdensome tens of thousands of insane. And all this was but a platform for far wider campaigns on which the Reich was to embark now that it was at war. And that's the end of that chapter. Some dark stuff, but it can be argued whether or not it was necessary or done well.